There is a whole chunk of mathematics called Fourier series and Fourier transform, which allows you to recalculate what new frequencies are present because of the way you have distorted that sine wave. As you start flat-topping it, as you start creating a different amount of slope during the crossover region, you start making the positive half of the sine wave bigger than the negative half, making the timing different. You do anything to a pure sine wave. And by the mathematics called Fourier series, you are generating other frequencies. And in some cases, you're going to be violating FCC rules about harmonic content out of your transmitter. Your second harmonic and third harmonic out of the transmitter is always supposed to be 60 decibels weaker than the main transmitter power. Otherwise, you're violating FCC rules for the quality of your transmitter. So, a single sideband signal is really done 99% of the time at low level. In other words, the early stages of the transmitter do a very fancy function, which usually starts off with a doubly balanced mixer, which does generate a... Let me jump for a second. Somewhere early in the transmitter, there's a doubly balanced mixer, which when it's properly used and balanced, gives you an output signal that is double sideband suppressed carrier. So the doubly balanced mixer, properly used in the early stage of the transmitter, removes all carrier, but leaves the upper and lower sideband. Then downrange, there is a very fancy, sharp filter that either filters out the upper sideband and transmits it to the rest of the transmitter, and you call that an upper sideband, single sideband signal, or you position the filter in the other side so that the lower sideband is being passed by the filter. So the low-level stages usually generate the signal. There's a pretty fancy process required to really make single sideband, and then all the stages downrange from there must be thoroughly linear so that it can tolerate the peak envelope power and all other characteristics of that signal so that proper amplification on all subsequent stages takes place without adding or subtracting anything from that complicated waveform. A single sideband signal is a fairly complicated waveform. And the linearity of all of your stages, particularly the final stage, is very important in order to make a non-distorted transmission of single sideband. And there's a whole lot of fancy test procedures like the two-tone test. If you've got a really good single sideband transmitter, and in the microphone circuit, in the microphone circuit, you plug in two audio tones. I'm going to pick numbers out of the air. 870 and 550 hertz, for instance. You put those two tones into the microphone circuit, and two very distinct sinusoidal signals should come out of that transmitter of equal power, and no other signals should be present. That's a two-tone test linearity confirmation of the total transmitter chain. Two-tone test is a very severe test. Properly done, it really tells you what is the quality of your single sideband transmitter. So, will a rectifier in the diode, in the antenna do that? Not a chance. And if you think it will, I'm going to sell you that bridge again that I own, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
Yeah, I think I already own a piece of that bridge, KC2WGB. Well, I understand his logic and how what he was thinking about, but a great description. I'm sure he has a much better understanding. And I know he can do a little reading online, and that may help him along understanding exactly why that won't work. But all right, great. I'll get on to the next one here. Miller Trap.
And by the way, if you Google the word single sideband transmitters or single sideband receivers, guarantee you get thousands of hits, and some of them are very good. The early book on the subject, the Bible on the book, single sideband transmitters, was done by a man named Pappin Fuss. Not quite sure how it's spelled, but although it's an old McGraw-Hill book, there's some very good books on the subject with some good illustrations. Over to you, John. Wait for the beeps.
Okay, Dick, we have an antenna question here. Actually, it's a Ballon question. He understands the balance work, but he's confused with the ratios, 4 to 1, 2 to 1, 1 to 1. How do you know what balance to pick with the antenna you're using? I think that's a question that's never been covered. Over to you, Dick.
Under normal circumstances, if I had an antenna that might be a fancy Yagi antenna with a gamma match or a T match, and the impedance matching device on the driven element of the antenna comes out with 50 ohms, and if I want to make sure that no RF energy is crawling down the outside of the coax cable when I'm feeding that antenna, I might put in a 1-to-1 balance. I've got a 50-ohm transmitter, a 50-ohm cable, and a 50-ohm antenna. And a 1-to-1 balance would be appropriate. If instead I'm feeding an ordinary dipole at a reasonable altitude, where the impedance of the dipole is something like 72 ohms, and if I feed it with a 50-ohm transmitter, I'm going to get a 1.3 standing wave ratio. A very slight mismatch. And you're going to lose 1 or 2 tenths of a decibel of signal that could have gone to the antenna because of that mismatch. That's an extremely minor mismatch. And a 1-to-1 transformer would do the job beautifully. But if you want to be a real purist, I'm not sure of the exact ratio of 72 ohms to 50, but let me make a number. Let's assume that's a 1.25. If I could build a balun that is doing the baluning action, which I'll describe in a second, and simultaneously it's doing an impedance match by a 1.25 ratio, then that would be a great way to go. There are certain kinds of antennas, like a half-wave coaxial fed dipole, where you get a 4-to-1 impedance step up in the structure of the driven element of the antenna. And so now I would really like to feed the antenna with a transmitter that has 200 ohms of impedance. And my transmitter is really 50. And the ratio between the two is 4-to-1. So in theory, I can go out and buy or build. Let me drop it. I can buy or build a balun that simultaneously gives me the baluning action and simultaneously is giving me a 4-to-1 impedance ratio. It's doing two things at once. So once you know the nature of the load you're feeding, and in some cases the load may not be a pure resistor. It might be a 200-ohm resistor in series with a 50-ohm capacitance. And in theory, you can design a balun that handles that. It's a kind of a filter, impedance matching, balancing device. So you can really combine all kinds of things there. And maybe even with DC isolation in it, if that's what you want. Or shunting to make sure that lightning is being properly corrected, connected to ground. High voltage picked up by the transformer. A good balance can do some of that for you, too. Now, what is the real balancing action? In the case of feeding a dipole, as I've told you guys a number of times, Mother Nature really likes a balanced circuit. It's hard to believe, but if I'm a mile away from the space shuttle, in orbit, I'm really in free space. I'm a mile away from that other piece of hardware, and I'm 160 miles above the surface of the Earth. I'm 5% of the way toward the moon or something like that. I'm really in free space. It's hard to believe that in that environment, I try to make a tiny little transmitter in the middle of my dipole, my 80-meter dipole, and the output of the transmitter is trying to issue 100 volts of difference between the right-hand side and the left-hand side of the dipole in the center, right at the center insulator. I get this tiny little transmitter, and I'm trying to put 100 volts across it. Mother Nature will force that dipole to have positive 50 volts on the right side, negative 50 volts on the left side during the first half cycle, and opposite polarity on the second half cycle. She will force balance. You try to feed that dipole in free space with a coax cable, where you take the shield of the coax cable, connect it to the left-hand side of the dipole, and the center conductor to the right-hand side, and assuming now it's a 70-ohm piece of cable, and it's a 70-ohm dipole, you think you've done a good job. Well, that 50 volts positive on the right side of the dipole and 50 volts negative on the left side means that after that beautiful 100-volt signal flows down the center conductor and shield on the inside of your coax cable and it hits the dipole and Mother Nature forces that balance, the 50 volts of RF energy on the left-hand side of the dipole directly connected to your coax cable we will be attempting to launch 50 volts of RF energy back down the outside of your coax cable. You think your coax cable is a transmission line. It has just become part of the antenna. It's part of the radiating structure.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Your coax cable has just become part of the radiating structure. It has added extra length to the left-hand side of the dipole. It has knocked it out of resonance. And you've got RF energy in the shack. And a bunch of bad things happening. You've got a very distorted antenna pattern. In most cases, that's bad. And if that coax cable happens to be running down the elevator shaft of your apartment building and running by your neighbor's apartment and then back into your shack, and the cable itself is hot with RF, you can be giving that neighbor a hell of a lot of television interference, telephone interference, radio interference, hi-fi interference. You can be giving, you can be pumping a lot of RF energy into his house, even though the cable doesn't go there. It just goes near it. So there's a bunch of disadvantages of having RF energy on the outside of the cable. What the so-called Balun does, when you mount that Balun device right at the end of the coax cable where it connects to the antenna, it's a nice mechanical structure which allows you to easily mount the dipole on whatever your support is. It's got a nice input connector. It's got weatherproofing. It's got all of those good physical properties. But it's got this other magic property. It is an RF choke for the outside of the coax cable. The signal flowing down the center of the coax cable doesn't even know it's going through a Balun. But for the signal that tries to get launched back down the outside of the coax cable, it looks at this Balun-ing device and says, that's an RF choke. The RF cannot flow beyond it. It gets stopped right there. And now your beautiful balanced antenna acts like a balanced antenna. Your coax cable is cold RF-wise in more ways than one. And everything's hunky-dory. To feed a dipole, a thoroughly symmetric antenna, without feeding it with a symmetric transmission line. Let me drop. If I was feeding that 72-ohm dipole with 72-ohm twin-lead coaxial cable, a 72-ohm twin-lead transmission line, which I had properly fed with the right kind of a balancing device in the shack, which properly launched a symmetric signal on that twin-lead transmission line, now I don't need a balancing device at the antenna, but I need one in the shack to take the 50-ohm unbalanced output from a transmitter and launch it into the 72-ohm twin-lead cable, balanced cable, symmetric cable. So you got to worry about these, what look like minor details. It's not going to crash and burn if you simply quickly connect the coax cable directly to a dipole. But don't leave it that way very long. That's a temporary installation. It's sloppy, and it could give you a fair amount of grief downrange, and there's a much way, better way of doing it. A poor man's Balun would be making an RF choke out of 3 or 4 turns of coax cable taped together right near the antenna. That's the kind of RF choke. But these Balun devices you can buy do a much better job mechanically as well as electronically. You got to worry about one other thing with Balun, though. Let me drop. If you buy a Balun, it's rated from 80 to 10 meters at a kilowatt, and you want to go down to 160 meters, a much lower frequency than it was designed for, and you want to put a kilowatt into it, there's a 50-50 chance you're going to get some smoke and flames. As you go down in frequency on a Balun, usually the performance degrades. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the tech man.
Very good information, Dick. I'm sure he learned a lot from that. Yeah, you know, it's something that's not covered in too many articles. You can read a little bit about it on the web, but the basic explanation of what's going on and what it's doing seems to confuse people. So I think he'll do well with that information, and he can work on from there. But now I think we should go to Paul because it's getting late, and after Paul, I have a question on a battery charger.
Okay, and maybe even it's a battery minder type charger. WS2N, how has Curiosity been doing, and how have you been doing? Over to you, Paul. And by the way, tell us once again, I think you were out of power for a few days during Hurricane Sandy. Is that true? WS2N, K2RIW. WS2N, Paul, are you still there? K2RIW. waiting for Paul to come back. Maybe he stepped away from the rig for a few minutes. John, go right ahead with your battery question.
Okay, Dick, I hope this doesn't bite into Paul's time. Maybe he got a phone call. KC2WGB, you and I were discussing the battery minder type chargers last week, and you had started to give a description on how it was working, and it also included there was an AC waveform of 2 volts above and below the charging voltage, and you were going to elaborate on it later on, and you never did. I think this would be a good time, if you can, to cover that in a little more detail. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
Okay. Now, what I'm going on is a description that was given to me by Kent, WA5EJB, who used to work for a company in Texas that manufactured a product like Battery Minder, but it was a different brand name. And what they had discovered is that if there is a sine wave superimposed on the charging current going into a lead-acid battery, all kinds of good things can happen. Now, I'm not sure of the exact magnitudes I'm about to give you, but I'm going to give you a bunch of numbers that I pulled out of the air to convey a concept. Okay? Make believe I've got a isolation transformer. And from the secondary winding of the transformer, which has got a real heavy piece of wire in the secondary winding, at one end of the secondary winding, I put an ordinary battery charger, and let's assume that I want to charge my lead-acid battery at, I'm going to pick a number, 2 amperes. So I got 2 amperes of current flowing from one end of the secondary winding, through the secondary winding, coming out of the secondary winding, into the battery, and the other end of the battery is grounded. So by way of the secondary winding, 2 amperes of current is flowing into the battery at 12 volts. And now in the primary of that transformer, that isolation transformer in this example, I put I'm going to pick a number, I might be too high, I'm going to pick a 14 volt peak sine wave, 14 volt peak to peak sine wave. So in the primary of this one-to-one transformer, I'm putting a 14-volt high-power sine wave. What does the battery see? The battery sees the charger current of 2 amperes at 12 volts.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater.
The battery is going to see the 12 volts at 2 amperes coming out of the ordinary battery charger, going through that secondary winding into the battery being charged. Simultaneously, it's looking at this 14-volt peak-to-peak in my example. And by the way, the battery charger, in order for this to all work out right, the battery charger has to be a constant current generator. The constant current generator is issuing 2 amperes regardless of what voltage it sees. There are all kinds of chargers that act that way. There's all kinds of circuits you can make that are a constant current output. So we got the constant current output set at 2 amperes and 2 volts. Correction, 2 amperes at roughly 12 volts. And if that was all that's going on, the lead-acid battery would be charged in the old-fashioned way. But now you're superimposing this 14-volt peak-to-peak sine wave, 14 volts, but yeah, peak-to-peak sine wave, at, let me pick a number, 100 kilohertz. So on the positive half cycle, the battery charger is seeing much more than 2 amperes on the positive half cycle. On the negative half cycle, it's actually seeing something a little bit in the negative direction, negative current, for a short period of time. The average current is 2 amperes, and the sine wave of 100 kc is superimposed on it. As far as the battery is concerned, it's getting its continuous current of 2 amperes, and charging is taking place. However, those sulfating particles or whatever that are on the plate of the battery being charged are being shaken violently at a 100 kilohertz rate of that sine wave coming out of that transformer. So the simultaneous sine wave and the simultaneous constant current, that combination does desulfate. It will do restoration of a lead acid battery. Now the numbers.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
The numbers I've just given you might be wrong. In other words, the 14 volt peak to peak sine wave I just described might be too big. And maybe it doesn't have to be a pure sine wave, but still there is a significant magnitude of alternating current superimposed on a direct current. And if you're smart enough with combining circuits, I use an isolating transformer in this case, but there are simpler ways of doing it. There are ways that you can be combining a sinusoidal light. Does it have to be a pure sine wave or can be a rectified sine wave? There, I'm not sure. Superimposed with this other current that's really doing the charging the battery. The combination of the two somehow shakes away these undesired sulfating particles, shakes them off the plates, dissolves them, sends them into the air as a gas. I'm not sure where they go and how this all happens, but by some magic, that combination of what this battery minder-like circuit does will restore a battery that's been sulfated. You take an ordinary lead-acid battery in your automobile and leave the headlights on at nighttime, and you come back the next morning and the headlights are now down to a dim voltage. Your 12-volt battery is down to 4 volts, I'm going to say. You've now thoroughly discharged that lead-acid battery. Under normal circumstances, depending on how much you discharge it and how long you leave it in the discharge rate state, does a significant amount of damage to the battery. From then on, the ampere hours of that battery are much lower than when it was first manufactured. Let me drop. And most people will call that condition a sulfated battery. And in theory, if you choose the right brand name and model number that has the right amount of characteristics that are proportional to your particular battery, you buy the right battery minder-like device, and you connect it to that sulfated, damaged car battery, and you do that for the next couple of days. I'm not sure what the restoration time is. I think in average cases, it's a couple of days. But once you connect that damaged car battery to this properly chosen battery minder-like device, a couple of days downrange, you have a restored car battery that probably has 95% of the original performance back in that battery as far as ampere hours are concerned. So that's what I'm told. KC2WGB, and I guarantee there's more to the story. K2LIW in the tech net.
B3ZTZ with info.
Go right ahead, Scott. Wait long enough for the beeps and give us your info, because I know you guys have been using them a lot longer than we have down here. I'm going on some speculation of what I've heard for a guy that I'm getting third-hand information. You guys have been there and done it, so give us a straight poop on this one, Scott. BE3ZTZ, K2RAW in the TechNet.
Scott in Toronto, BE3ZTZ returning. Just, I think, a piece of the puzzle you may be missing because it's chemistry, not electronics. A battery that's sulfided, the sulfidization process forms a crystal lattice, which has physical and electrical properties. The frequency, the AC frequency that's imposed on the DC charging current works like you described, but it shatters the crystal, the sulfur crystal lattice. When the lattice is shattered, the sulfur returns back into the electrolyte. So that's maybe the piece you're missing about, you said, where did it go? I don't know. That's what's happening, is the crystal lattice is being shattered by the electromotive force of the high swing positive and the back high swing negative. The lattice is being physically shattered, and the sulfur turns to chemical suspension and acts as the, essentially the pH will revert back to what it should be to perform the battery operation. The E3ZTZ.
Okay, that sounds awfully good. So these crystals of sulfated crystals that are on the surface of the plate of the battery are bad, they're insulators. They're locking up some of the chemistry. So once you do a desulfating operation, alpha is returned to the solution. The solution of the battery, the electrolyte, is primarily a sulfuric acid, so the sulfur's got to be there. So once a battery has had this method of restoration, my guess is that my hygrometer, the thing that measures the specific gravity of the fluid in the battery and tells you the state of charge, my guess is that's going to tell me I've got a higher concentration of sulfuric acid, and the battery therefore looks like it's more thoroughly charged after I've done that operation. That's a bunch of guesses on my part, and correct me if I'm wrong on that one, Scott. B3ZTZ in Toronto, K2RIW in the Tech Minute.
Acknowledge, that's my understanding, and it's two parts. One is the electrolyte is returning to proper pH, and the crystals are physically removed from the plate, which were acting as an insulator, as you commented on. So it's a two-part game, and both are necessary. B3ZTZ.
And those crystals that were on the plate were acting as a partial insulator, so that now the plate did not have the contact to the electrolyte that it desires. Therefore, the active surface area of the plate has been decreased. That's less ampere hours. And again, because the active area has been decreased, the apparent equivalent series resistance of the battery gets increased by those insulating crystals. So by getting rid of those crystals, your internal resistance of the battery is lower. It can issue more cold cranking amperes, and it's got more ampere hours of capacity. Other than that, it's pretty good. Is that approximately true, Scott? BE3ZTZ, K2RIW?
Working off years of anecdotal experience, that is correct. Only other piece I can add, and it's again from reading, so you have to take what you read with a grain of salt and believe what you choose to believe. But because it's a crystal lattice structure formed around the sulfur molecule, there's an optimum sine wave frequency, and I believe it's in the 3-point-something, 3.1, 3.4 megahertz range. I'm not sure about that, and that's the difference between some of the different brands. I think VDC or VCD or VDC Electronics has the original patent on the optimum frequency, and some of the Me Too brands use different frequencies that are close, but perhaps arguably not quite as good. That's about the limit of my understanding on the frequency and the crystallization of E3ZTZ.
Looks like you've got some good experience here, Scott. Now, if I'm going out and buying a battery minder-like circuit, does it have to be properly sized as a minimum size for a particular battery? In other words, if I buy one that is sized to work correctly on my 35 ampere hour car battery, and then at a later time I decide to use it on a much smaller motorcycle battery, and at a later time I decide to use it on my gel cell that's part of my handheld flashlight, is that a doable situation? Is there a way I can reset the battery minder because I'm using a smaller and smaller battery? Or would I just always use it full blast and as long as I got one big enough? Or conversely, if I buy one that's appropriate for my motorcycle battery, would it still work on my much bigger car battery, but now I've got to wait a longer period of time for the restoration? So what is the size compatibility between the particular model of battery minder I buy and the particular battery that I'm restoring? PE3ZTZ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Scott from Toronto, Canada, PE3ZTZ returning. Now, here's one I may have some indirect information on that bears straight to point without giving away. VDC might not have given away a trade secret. They originally produced a 1-amp trickle charger, as well as a series of 2-amp and 8-amp and some of the big boys. And they withdrew the 1-amp from the market and came out with a 1.33 amp version of it. Same form factor, same case, same styling. They just upped the amperage to the trickle charge to 1.3 amp. 1.33 amps of current charge, constant current charge. And it turns out that that's the breakover threshold to completely guarantee the shattering of the crystal lattice. So amperage below that works, but not completely, not guaranteed. Amperage at 1.33 seems to be the threshold. So I stumbled across that because they replaced a couple of units that I had bought courtesy. I'm going to trip. The rest of the sizing, it's just like any, because as you mentioned, it's a constant current charger. The safest rate for most batteries to be charged is 1/2 C, where C is the constant output it can deliver. Most batteries are safely charged at 1/2 C. So as you go down in size, you want your charger at full blast to not exceed 1/2 C to maintain long-term health of the battery. The number one enemy of sulfuric acid-based batteries is heat, not cold, as many people think. If you charge above 1/2 C rate, you tend to generate internal heat that becomes detrimental to the battery over long term. You decrease the number of charge cycles that you can put it through.
Okay, so 1/2 C rate. And now, let me come to a specific example. If my particular car battery is good for 35 ampere hours, does that mean, in theory, I could be charging it at half of 35 amp, 17 amp rate? And my guess is that the battery minder doesn't go that high. Correspondingly, if my little bitty gel cell is good for 1 ampere hour, does that mean I could charge it as high as half an ampere? And hopefully this battery minder has got a knob on it where I can turn it down to half an ampere when I'm charging this little bitty gel cell, a 1 ampere hour gel cell. That's question number one. And question number two, when I'm applying the battery charger, the battery minder, to do a restoration operation, would I be better off starting with the battery mostly discharged or mostly charged? Is there a difference in the starting condition of the battery when I apply it to the battery minder in order to get best overall performance? VE3ZTZ, K2RIW on the TechNet.
I've used two different brands, and they operate differently. And within the brands, there are different models. I have two of the 1.33 amp trickle chargers, and I have the big boy at 8 amp, and it's microprocessor controlled. You hook the battery up to it, and it figures it out and just goes. The other brand, the non-VDC brand, is from Optima, and it has the integral processor claims. You've dead flattened zero charge in the battery, dead flattened sulfuric acid-based battery, whether it's gel or otherwise. The Optima does a 20-volt negative volt spiking trick. Spikes it, lets it rest. And it will bring a battery back from the dead, get some charge in the electrolyte, and then it will perform the maintenance cycles. The VDC ones, there has to be some charge in the battery. The battery has to be prepared to have some charge in it to accept more charge. That's the difference I found between the Optima brand and the VDC brand.
I'm going to make some guesses as to what goes on here. I've got a Sears Roebuck brand car battery charger. Suppose supposedly microprocessor controlled, ordered about 5 or 10 years ago, and it will never put out more than, let me pick a number, 14 volts. And I've had a damaged battery act in such a way that the 14 volts coming out of the charger resulted in literally 0 amperes going into what I thought was a dead battery. I tried to start the car with that battery, and I did a click of the solenoid, but no real starting action. I try to run the headlights, and the voltage jumps down real fast. But I apply 14 volts to it, and no charging current occurs. If by some external means I can force even a trickle charge of that battery of, let me pick a number, 18 or 19 volts, and it starts drawing current, apparently the completely resistive surface of maybe these sulfated crystals, I start burning through them, and I start finding some active area of those plates. And all of a sudden, when I've done that enough, I start getting charging action. So this spiking operation with reverse polarity, I think, is trying to break down that insulating layer that, in the extreme case, is completely insulating at least one of those plates, and the battery acts like an open circuit until you exceed a particular breakover voltage. That's what I've experienced. BE3ZTZ, K2RIW. Go ahead, Scott.
I would concur that that's one possible and probable explanation. I know that from my experience with some nickel-cadmium batteries, there are some YouTube videos around where, you know, you take an electric welder and you flash a second arc weld NiCad battery. That it'll do the breakover, and they'll begin accepting charge from a regular charger. There's all sorts of YouTube videos out there. The theory behind that, as I understand it, and it's possibly the theory at work with the negative voltage spike charging that the Optima brand puts is capable of, is that essentially you're coming at it, instead of a cathode-anode point of view, you're coming at it anode-cathode point of view in the battery. You're sort of coming in the back door with instead of the front door, and you're trying to get some current movement that way. V3ZTZ.
There could be something a little bit different going on with the NiCad, though, Scott. I've had a number of battery packs that consist of a number of series cells of nickel-cadmium batteries. And if you've made the mistake of deeply discharging that battery pack, and what usually happens is one of the cells, you know, 3 years downrange, one of the cells is lower in ampere hours than the others that are part of the pack. And eventually that particular cell becomes reversed charged during the discharging operation. As such, it starts growing whiskers, and eventually the whiskers it grows creates a complete short circuit between the anode and cathode of that particular cell. And then if you start off with a, let me pick a number, 1,000 microfarad capacitor, charged to, let me pick a number, 15 volts, and you put that charged capacitor with 15 volts on it across the so-called bad cell, which now, because of the whiskers it grew, it's a dead short circuit in both directions, milliohms of resistance. And you now put that charged 1,000 microfarad, 15 volt capacitor across that cell, you burn away that whisker, and now the whole battery pack will accept the charge. And you're back in operation to some degree. However, I've discovered that that so-called damaged cell that had the whiskers that you just burned away, let me drop. In the process of burning away the short circuit whisker with the capacitor discharge on the bad cell, you restored it to a condition where it can now accept the charge. But the carbonized path you left when you burned away that whisker is a leakage path. You'll discover that the internal leakage of that cell is multiple times higher than the other cells. That as long as you're willing to charge that battery every day, you'll think everything's hunky-dory. You take that battery pack and you put it on the shelf for a week, and you come back a week later, and you find all the cells are charged except the one that you just repaired. He has drained himself to ground with internal leakage. So, although you get a kind of repair, it's a very hobbled repair as I see it. So the whisker phenomena of NICADs, a reverse charging, I think is one of the mechanisms of damage. I don't think a lead-acid battery develops whiskers. I think the sulfated crystals are much more of what's going on. That's a bunch of guesses on my part, Scott. B3ZTZ, K2LIW in the tech net.
Having heard you point that out, it would be two very different effects with the two very different effects with the different chemistries. I probably should withdraw that there's the cathode anode effect going on with the Optima charger, that it's trying to charge from the back door instead of the front, to use very non-scientific terms. I'm not sure then I understand what's going on with the Optima brand charger, but I do know this. The Optima will, if you're one of those people who's lazy and leaves the battery out in the barn or the garage and lets them go dead, you need to bring them back to life. The Optima is much better at bringing back an absolute dead battery to useful life. The VDC-based ones are used routinely, do a superior job at maintaining the life of that battery for many, many, many years. I cannot tell you, they're pricier compared to just standard chargers. On my motorcycle batteries, they've saved me hundreds of dollars over many seasons, plus not having the frustration of a dead motorcycle battery and then having to push the motorcycle home is a big plus, or pay for the tow to get it home. And the other thing is, as I mentioned, I have duplicated my UPS batteries, and I alternate them through my UPSs at the clock changes fall backwards and spring forward. I take my UPS batteries out, put them on the battery miser, put the other ones back in, and let them sit in UPS. And I've had those UPS batteries in there for years now, and I know that they'll give me the full 90 minutes that they're sized for. So I can't say enough about the VDC product, as much as I hate recommending product on the air, because your mileage will vary. VE3ZTZ.
John, good information, and I thank you. One last question, Scott. My buddy, who worked for a factory that built a kind of a battery minder-like circuit, but it had some other brand name that I've forgotten. He either knew directly or speculated, here I'm not sure, that the battery itself really has the equivalent of some number of microfarads or farads of capacitance. So the battery viewed as a capacitor, he felt, was put across an inductive circuit and resonated. And now the apparent microfarads of capacitance of the battery combined with the inductor of the charging circuit, that in turn set the resonating frequency at which the AC potential was applied to the battery during the restoration process. If that's true, depending on whether I'm putting in a gel cell from a UPS or a motorcycle battery or a car battery, you would think that the resonating frequency is going to be quite different, and that would seem to conflict a little bit with that patent about 3.1 megacycles as the ideal frequency for doing this desulfating or decrystallization operation. You might have an opinion or some extra knowledge on that one, Tim. Scott, VE3ZTZ, K2LIW.
Once again, coming at it from the consumer and in having watched their product evolve, they used to sell their chargers by category. And about 5 years ago, maybe a little longer, they now sell one charger that works with all the chemistries, all the sulfuric acid-based chemistries, so gel, vented, non-sealed lead, et cetera, et cetera. And polyvalent, and I suspect that the microprocessor in there now, if you're correct, and because it is a physical crystallization that gets shattered. What you said your friend conveyed to you makes a lot of sense, that you're finding, it's like hitting the high C and shattering crystal. That's exactly what it's doing, and it would be different for different batteries, sizes and chemistries. That the microprocessor in the VDC, now that they've consolidated their lines, knows what that is or can sense it out and then uses it. Because they did go from specific chemistry, having like 11 different models, down to one model with a microprocessor. V3, as he said.
That's all very good to know, Scott. I thank you. Glad you signed in tonight. We're slowly getting a lot smarter. Many of us down here have lived with lead-acid batteries that we think they've got a very finite life. If you're lucky, you can get 5 years out of them in an automobile. And some of us have only gotten 2 or 3 years because we left the lights on one, so to speak. And I'm now getting the impression that that's not a permanent damage situation, that with the right kind of a charging circuit, that so-called damaged car battery can be brought back to nearly full performance. I used to think also that the end of life of the battery used to have a whole lot of particles flaking down to the bottom, and eventually those particles down the bottom create a short circuit between some of the plates. And what are those particles that flake off and go down to the bottom of the battery? With proper restoration, is there no flaking? Looks like I've got another whole question here. Is there anything to this flaking theory of particles being built up at the bottom of the battery? Some of the advertisements I used to see 20 years ago showed car batteries with particles flaking off the plates, piling up into the bottom of the battery inside of the electrolyte, and eventually if there wasn't a deep enough well at the bottom, those particles would build up to the plate, to the altitude where they start shorting out the plates. And this particular brand, let me drop. This particular brand of battery was claiming they had a deeper well that it could tolerate more particles, and therefore the battery had more life. So, are these particles a function of the sulfating and the crystals breaking away? And now if you're doing continuous restoration, you no longer have this particle build up at the bottom. I wonder if you've got any opinions on that one, Scott. VE3ZTZ, K2LIW in the ZNET.
Well, we're getting a little further away from what I know to what I believe, and belief can always be in error, but the physical construction of most modern batteries are not plates immersed in fluid. The plates are separated by fiberglass mats or hairs, or their spiral coils, similarly separated by an insulated material, but that allows the electrolyte to still flow through them. As a result of the finishing process of the surface, the metal surface itself, the lead, and this compacting them very close together but separated by glass fibers. I don't think you get the particulate that you're referring to from once upon a time. That's me speculating. I don't know, but I think modern physical construction and manufacturing techniques may have dispatched that. But that's me guessing. VE3ZTZ.
Okay, you've given us the caveats, but still that's very good information, Scott. You're getting me smarter. Back in the days when you used to have a little cap you could open up for each individual cell, and you were supposed to pour some distilled water in there to keep the level up to a certain level, and if you aimed your flashlight down that open hole, you would see individual plates with fluid in between them. You don't see that anymore. First of all, now they're all completely sealed structures. You don't get a chance to see them anymore. But I have heard about this fiberglass mat, and there's a 3 or 4 letter abbreviation for the whole class of lead acid batteries that have this mat in it. I can't remember the 3 letter.
AGM.
Well, let's have that again. What's all the letters?
Alpha George Mike.
Okay. And Alpha George Mike stands for what?
Absorbent glass mat.
Fantastic. So the absorbent glass mat is allowing the proper spacing between the plates, making sure that they don't warp and touch each other. It also allows tighter packing, I am guessing, closer plate spacing, because it is controlling the distance between the plates, and any particulate matter that might want to leave the plates and flake down the bottom is being held by the glass mat, and in this battery restoration process, in theory, those particles get put back into the right position. I'm guessing on a bunch of things there, but looks like modern design of lead-acid batteries, so-called AGM batteries, is the right way to go. We're getting better. Anybody have any further questions or comments? Give me your call letters right now. K2LIW and the Tech Man.
E3 Juliet India Whiskey.
Go right ahead there, Jim. E3JIW.
Thank you for taking me quick the last time. We were just closing the cottage. I mean the car. There's another thing that glass mat batteries might do is there is not a technical surface of the electrolyte to get extreme corrosion of an electrode passing through the surface of the electrolyte. I don't have the figures. It's something Mr. Google could help, but there's several advantages to the construction. If you're going to get into the difference of batteries, remember, automotive batteries, lead 1, 2, and 3 oxide batteries that don't have caps to check are a different isotope or plate material. So they don't use the amount of water. So if you want to get into the construction of batteries, maybe that's a whole topic. But I have a car battery that has removable caps, and I look down, and it looks like old-style battery to me. And I should email the battery to Scott, and he could try to resolve it, because as soon as I start the car and it barely starts, my AC says I got 14.6 volts. So I've got a battery that's not taking any current. The voltage goes right up, and there's virtually no current being taken by the battery because it has very little reserve. So anyway, to back to net, the K2RIWVE3JIW.
So depending on what brand and when it was built and what brand of car and when it was built, looks like there's various kinds of sealed and not-so-sealed lead-acid batteries. And I guess there's also the so-called marine-type deep discharge, higher calcium battery, and so on. Looks like there's a lot of different methods of construction and chemistry going on here. And I presume, one further question here, Scott, and that is, if I am using the so-called marine-type deep discharge battery, to your knowledge, the VDC electronics and the Optima, do each of those claim that they also properly handled that kind of lead-acid battery? VE3ZTZ, K2RIW.
Scott from Toronto, VE3ZTZ, returning. Yes, they do handle marine deep discharge, deep cycling batteries. I was going to mention, again, without peddling a brand, VDC does make a gizmo. I've not tried it, but you actually, it's designed for in-place use, and it ties across your battery terminals in your vehicle under the hood. And using whatever voodoo it claims to do, I guess it would be a voltage doubler of some sort. It applies the frequency for the desulfidization process across the terminals of the battery, in place, in your engine, off your alternator voltage. Not sure how it does that, but they do have a gizmo for about $50 that will do that in place, if you want to explore that. But they do work with gels and deep cycle marines, VE3ZTZ.
Fascinating. And that $50 voodoo circuit that's in continuous use in the automobile, and it's in, you and I are going to speculate, it's impressing a sinusoidal-like voltage, maybe at a 3 megacycle rate, across the battery. And if now with my heavy 6-gauge wires that go through the firewall from my battery and go into my Mirage amplifier and the rest of my radio equipment that's in the passenger compartment of the car, is it going to be happy with that sinusoidal presence of that voltage? If the sinusoidal voltage is, let me pick a number, 100 millivolts at a 3 megacycle rate, except for a little bit of a sideband that might appear on my transmission, I think nobody would be the wiser. That's if it's millivolts. But if it's multiple volts of sine wave on the so-called 12-volt line going to my electronics, I think my electronics is going to be unhappy. For that matter, I'm reasonably sure that the emission control computer and the microprocessors on the instrument panel and everything else in the car would be unhappy. I'm led to believe that that voodoo circuit must only be putting out a small number of millivolts in order not to disturb everything else in the car. DE3ZTZ for any further speculations, and we'll take your caveats on this one, Scott. KQIIW in the TechNet.
I have, as I said, I have not purchased, and I don't know anyone who's using the in-place version of their product. What I can offer is this with regard to the radio. I'm not presently running, but I have run a mobile rig off of some recovered batteries from, I guess they were fire alarms or emergency lighting, so they're 12 volt. I think they were 8 or 9 amp hours. Four of them in parallel that were being continuously charged by the 8 amp version of the battery minder. And I was running the radio off of the battery. The batteries, which were also connected to the battery minder, in charge mode. And if you operated the radio long enough, you'd obviously draw enough amps, the VDC would kick in from trickle charge to full-on charge, where it's dumping the full 8 amp in. No person I was talking to ever complained that there was a buzz, a hum, or anything in the transmission when it was either in trickle mode or when it was in full-on 8 amp charge mode. Motorola Max Track Radio. VHF, V3ZTZ, for whatever that's worth.
That's a good sign. I'm led to believe, Scott, that a fully charged, fully restored lead-acid battery of the kind that's in an automobile, which has something in the vicinity of 30 or 40 ampere hours of capacity, it probably has an equivalent series resistance of a few milli-ohms, and therefore, unless you had hundreds of amperes of AC signal, that battery is the world's biggest capacitor. For all I know, it's acting like a 5-farad capacitor. And therefore, even though you're putting a whopping big AC current across that battery, because of its very small internal equivalent series resistance, I'm led to believe that only a few millivolts of actual AC voltage is appearing across those terminals. A fully restored battery operating in that manner, I think it's going to have very little AC voltage. And whether that AC voltage be at 100 KC or 3 megacycles, I think is not much of a problem. Unless I wanted to listen to the 3.1 megacycle frequency region, and maybe I'd hear something. And I'd know to tune to some other frequency. So I'm making some guesses here as to how this all works. Obviously, there's probably quite a bit of proprietary information as to how each of these brands do it, and they probably hold some of this information fairly close to their chest. It's their advantage between other brands. Let me drop. Anybody have any further questions or comments or information about these battery minder-like circuits and your experience with using one? I'm getting the impression that in the United States, a very small percentage of the population knows about these things and is using them. Because of the event we've just gone through and the amount of information being transmitted among people who are battery dependent, I think this is going to change quite a bit. I think the number of battery minders down here is about to double, is my guess. KQIIW listening, if anyone else want to make some comments.
WGB.
You got it, John.
Well, Dick, I know